Well, on the show today, we have a researcher from Singapore. Have you ever been to Singapore, Eddie?
I cannot say that I have.
Well, did you know that Singapore is pushing to be one of the biggest biotechnology hubs in the world?
Huh, I did not know that.
Yeah, I have a friend, Weilong Chu, who we'll be interviewing, who recently started his own lab in Singapore, and we'll kind of be going over what that process has been like for him.
Great, let's dive right in.
In today's podcast, we sit down with Weilong Chu, a researcher at the Genome Institute of Singapore who recently started his own lab. We discuss some of the joys and difficulties of getting a lab up and running and learn a little bit about what it was like for Weilong to work in George Church's lab as a graduate student. So yeah, I guess to start off, can you provide us with a little bit of introduction to who you are and kind of what your career path has been up to now?
Yeah, I'm Weilong Chu. I was born in Singapore, did my college at Duke, and then a PhD at Harvard, and I'm currently a PI at the Genome Institute of Singapore in ASTAR, so it's the Agency of Science, Technology and Research. We develop technology for synthetic biology and genome engineering.
Cool. And I guess, what kind of motivated you to get into this? Like, what was your background? What kind of research did you do before you started doing this kind of synthetic biology research?
I was in neuroscience.
Mm-hmm.
That was in college, and also slightly after college when I was doing my research assistantship. Subsequently, I went into genome engineering when I was in Harvard during my graduate school.
Why did you make that change? So why did you go from neuroscience into genome engineering?
I think it was really just chance. So I guess when I was young, I really enjoyed solitude. I think it drove a curiosity into the mechanism of what, you know, allows us to think. But when I went to college, I decided neuroscience is really what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I did a biology major with a concentration in neuroscience and a minor in philosophy. Those weren't really my strongest subjects when I was in high school, but I found them really fascinating, so I did my college in that. So after college, I did my research assistantship also in neuroscience,
mm-hmm.
and I wanted to pursue neuroscience as a PhD research. So I applied to 4 schools, all in the neuroscience program except for Harvard, where I applied for the biological and biomedical sciences, the BBS program, which is, as you know, an umbrella program, so it's not just for neuroscience, right? So, but after interviewing, I realized that, you know, maybe I should try something else and see what happens. So I decided to join Harvard because I could choose from a wide variety of labs. You know, the density of labs is just vast at Harvard. So that's like a small turning point.
Mm-hmm.
And I think within Harvard came the biggest turning point. So I thought it would be quite cool to engineer life, you know, specifically just through synthetic biology. So I think when we first started graduate school, synthetic biology isn't as quite a buzzword as it is now.
Sure, yeah. And what year was this, just so people...
that was, what, 2010?
Yep.
Well, I mean, 7 years in science is quite a long time.
Yeah, definitely.
So there was this lab that I really thought I wanted to join. So I went to talk to the PI, and I won't reveal who the person is, but... told me that I was definitely welcome, but you know, I could, because of space constraints, I would be better off just coming back after 2 or 3 months. So I had to find another lab for rotation, and it's kind of a, you know, filling up the time. So I looked through the lab websites and, you know, the BBS student handbook, and thought or learned about tech development from this church lab.
Mm-hmm.
I think people around me thought, well, then gave me the feedback that the church lab was quite like industry. It's not for graduate students, more for postdocs.
Sure. It's a very large lab, right? Like I guess, how many people were in it when you were rotating?
I think I think not even George knows how many people there are, but I think it fluctuates between 60 to 120 people.
Okay, yeah. So, I mean, that's essentially the size of AdGene, so, yeah.
Oh, sorry?
Yeah. We're about, I think, like 85 people right now. So, yeah, we're right in that range.
I see.
Yeah.
Well, it fluctuates with the season.
Yeah.
But really, it's not like industry, you know. I mean, I feel that people might misunderstand from the size of the lab.
Mm-hmm.
It's made out of kind of small different research groups, and many people are quite independent in what they do. In a quite an academic sense, but kind of out of this world sci-fi kind of academic research.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess what were some of your favorite projects going on while you were there?
I guess I joined the church lab, you know, thinking it was going to be a time filler. So I went to George and I said, you know, I want to rotate in your lab. And then he said, that's your bench. But when I started doing my rotation there, which was just for 2 months, I was really mind blown. The science is just out of this world most of the time. And people are really nice, collegial. So I really had a good time there. So, I mean, after the rotation, I ended up not joining the first lab because it was just such an excellent environment in the church lab. So that was the period when the Mage paper from the church lab was recently published, and also Dan Gibson and Craig Venter had the bacterial synthetic genome papers.
Sure.
Those really got me excited. So I joined the lab wanting to do wanted to synthesize a eukaryotic genome or chromosome.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I would develop technologies to build a yeast chromosome.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty ambitious for going from rotation student thinking about that.
Well, you know, the projects there are really quite outrageous sometimes, but very often they work.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the amazing thing about the lab.
Yeah.
And I thought it was something fun to do.
Yeah.
So a few months into this, ALENS was developed, and it started to look like we could really engineer the human genome much easier than before.
Mm-hmm.
So I started a side project to do postnatal gene correction in animals.
Mm-hmm.
Those were really exciting for me. I didn't really have the pressure of graduate school or publication, so I really was just exploring, you know, various technologies and imagining you know, ways of doing research. Then, about a year into graduate school, Prashant Mani, a postdoc lab, he said to me, you know, I'm developing this CRISPR thing. Do you want to try it out? You know, that was before the science papers were published.
Sure.
So I decided, you know, I did, and the efficiencies were just awesome, you know, compared to humans. So I dropped the synthetic genome project and dropped the Ethereum project and went fully focusing on developing CRISPR. And I guess I never looked back since.
So did you have an idea of kind of how crowded the CRISPR field was at that time? Like, did you know what you were getting into in terms of competition and that kind of thing?
Definitely not. I mean, in recent years, CRISPR is probably the most competitive sub-discipline in biology.
Mm-hmm.
But when I first started work, you know, back in the day of, you know, when TALENs were just developed and just the early months of CRISPR, there were only a handful of labs, I think, interested in genome engineering in general.
Mm-hmm.
So it's quite a niche field. And that was really fun, actually, because you know what everybody is doing and whatever you do seems to be just very novel.
Mm-hmm. Were you all actively talking to each other about your projects too?
Yes, because there were just so few people working in developing tools for genetic engineering that you kind of have to talk to some people. That's just a natural conversation and kind of a collegial environment, I think.
Sure,
culture.
Yeah. That, I imagine that made it much, much easier to do the work, too, because if you're constantly worried about somebody, you don't necessarily want to keep going down into that field. Was there ever a turning point while you were a grad student where it became more like competitive in a bad way as opposed to collegiate, or was it always good throughout the whole time?
I think CRISPR as a field has become so competitive in such a short time that by now I got used to it, but I would say when it first started becoming real competitive, it started to make people a little bit more tense.
Mm-hmm.
Also, as the group of people working on it grew, you get to have a few bad apples.
Mm-hmm.
But I still think in general, most of the people in this field, specifically in the technology development field, are quite nice.
Yeah.
Even though it seems like it is so competitive, but people tend to be nice. You know, I still talk to quite a couple of my friends from, you know, back in the day, back in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And we are all everywhere in the world now, but we still keep in touch in a very friendly manner.
Awesome, yeah. I mean, that's been our experience with people in technology development, particularly in genome engineering. I mean, everybody has been very good about depositing stuff with us, so that's been amazing.
Yeah.
And I think that general feel of wanting to share everything and get technologies actually used has been really useful for biology in general, which is awesome.
Yeah. I think maybe that's also why the science is moving so fast, especially with genome engineering, genome editing tools. It seems to be a kind of a prerequisite for it to be on Edgen.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So, I mean, when you read about the newest papers, you always try to get the newest reagents and, you know, keep going faster and faster. And I think it kind of built a strong momentum. Like, there's a critical mass of people doing this that if you don't put your reagents on there and you don't get reagents from Edgen, you feel that you will lose out quite fast.
Well, I'm glad to hear you feel that way. So then I guess my question for you as a grad student who is in kind of that somewhat competitive environment sometimes, is there any particular advice you could give somebody who is going to end up working in that kind of competitive environment? And I guess kind of how do you deal with this tense situations?
George is very hands-off, so he gives a lot of independence. Mm-hmm. which is great for me because I wanted that. And I think many people survive very well in such situations. But of course, there are some people who might prefer more hands-on PI, more mm-hmm. mentorship in the lab. I would say a hands-off PI in such a competitive environment for someone like that might not be ideal.
Mm-hmm.
In a big lab like this, usually I think people are expected to be independent.
Yeah.
And if you really do want help, be it in some kind of expertise in whatever new protocols or new technology, or just, you know, just interpersonal kind of advice, you really have to be proactive and go find people to talk to.
Mm-hmm. So really just kind of asking for help when you need it, I guess it would be the best way to go.
Yeah, of course. People are very friendly.
Mm-hmm.
So I think make friends, you know.
Yeah. No, I mean that is actually it sounds silly, but it's like an important thing for people to hear, because you can get stuck in the mindset where you just want to have your head down doing your experiments, but you got to talk to people if you want to succeed.
Yes, I think so. That's really cool.
And I'm sure as a PI now, you feel that even more, right? Do you feel that even more, that kind of the way forward is to collaborate more?
Yes. I mean, during graduate school, I also felt that way. But because I was more focused on finishing my thesis and publishing my paper, then I was more stuck in that lab mindset.
Mm-hmm.
So as gradually as I gotten used to running a lab, putting more emphasis on collaborating with other people, you know, if we do not have the expertise in certain areas, we will try to find people, and people try to find us too. I would say right now as a PI, I'm I'm very much more active in trying to find ways to collaborate with other labs and trying to encourage my lab members to collaborate also.
Sure. So a keen listener might have just realized that you started graduate school in 2010 and graduated in 2016, and you're already a PI. So can you tell us a little bit about how that ended up working?
I had quite a clear sense of what I wanted to do. Even during graduate school, I wanted to develop technology, and it could be in an industrial format, or it could be in a startup, or it could be in an academic format. So the key point is I wanted independence, and that is also why I joined the research lab in the first place, right? And so when I graduated and I was looking for a position, I did not look for a postdoc position. So my mindset was just, I'm either going to be an independent PI in academia, or I will try to find an industrial a job somewhere. I wanted to do something that is very cutting edge, mm-hmm. That is really not found back in Singapore. I knew I wanted to come back to Singapore.
Okay.
So the kind of technology that I wanted to do is not as mature in Singapore compared to Boston.
Sure.
And hence I wanted to have an independent position to do that.
It kind of benefited you to be going back to Singapore, where there was, like, this field just wasn't as developed. So definitely there was more of a space for you to develop a lab based off of that.
We definitely have the expertise that is, I would say, somewhat absent here in the region.
Mm-hmm.
People are using CRISPR. It's used around the world. It's not that people are not knowledgeable about using CRISPR. It's just that the technology development isn't as mature as in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're comparing with, an intellectual capital of the world. in that sense, you know, it benefited me, especially since CRISPR is now one of the hottest thing in biology. So
mm-hmm.
right before I came back to Singapore from Boston, I spoke to two institutes. One of them is the Genome Institute of Singapore, which I'm currently in.
Okay.
And I started this position.
Okay. So basically, you're essentially setting up like one of the first genome engineering labs within the institute that you're working at.
Not even within the institute. We set up the first genome engineering center in the region. I would safely say Southeast Asia. because it's just isn't as mature as the U.S. So yeah, it's really exciting because
that's awesome.
The funding agencies and the local community and the people here are just hugely supportive.
Mm-hmm.
People want to see a success and people want to work with the best technologies, and I think we contribute in bringing gene editing technologies to the local community.
Mm-hmm. So, and I don't know a lot about the details about what biology research is like in Singapore, but if I remember correctly, there's kind of like a big push for getting Singapore to be like a biotech capital of the world, right?
Yes. So from 10, 15 years ago when I was in high school, biomedical research wasn't mature at all, but when I was in high school, there was a strong national effort in trying to push for students to go into biology or to medicine,
mm-hmm.
and also into research,
mm-hmm.
Biomedical research. So there was a deliberate attempt in trying to make biomedical research a pillar of the economy. The national economy. So there was this emphasis in the study of biology. Now, from PhD onwards, the resources and infrastructure is also extremely good. I took up a scholarship that allowed me to go to Duke and also allowed me to go to pursue my PhD, and also got me a job back home in Vietnam. So I'm very appreciative of that. I guess without it, I probably would not be able to go overseas to learn about the cutting edge biology. Now that I'm back, I can also see that there's a lot of funding opportunities. Just in the last 5 years, or maybe the coming next 5 years, there was more than $10 billion spent in research funding in a small country like Singapore. So $10 billion over 5 years of a country of about 5 million. So I think that's huge.
Yeah.
So in terms of funding, I would say it's extremely good. For basic research, maybe a little bit tighter, and that's happening around the world. But for spin-offs, you know, commercialization or technology development or applied science, it really is quite attractive here.
Yeah. And in terms of, I guess, being able to collaborate with people around the world or even people in Singapore, are you enabled to be able to go talk to the people that you need to talk to, that kind of thing?
Yeah, so it's nice that A-Star is situated in Barbalis, next door, there's Fusionopolis. So it's 6,000 people or so, I think, scientists situated in a small neighborhood of buildings. It is a very dense concentration of intellectual people. So you could just walk next door or go for lunch with other people, go for coffee with other people. The environment is very vibrant, and it's also an international community, be it in the diversity of people and the diversity of the science. So
just a quick question. Do you all live in Biopolis too?
No.
Okay. So it's kind of like Boston, where nobody really lives in the city proper, but everybody lives kind of like in the outskirts a little bit.
Except for grad students who live in the lab.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it is.
Oh, that's cool. I guess, have there been any surprises in your academic life now that you're a PI? Is that everything you expected it to be?
I think graduate students, when I've heard of fourth year depression syndrome. I didn't have depression, but I definitely feel that things were much more intense and stressful.
Yeah.
Because the field is extremely competitive. I spent all my time in lab. At that point in time, I felt that research might just be being in lab all the time. So it's fun to a certain extent, but your life gets consumed.
Sure.
I think now we get to think a lot more. You know, my responsibility is trying to read more papers. I've been always enjoying reading papers, writing grants, talking to people, giving ideas or mentoring people in the lab. It makes for a much enjoyable scientific career. So in that sense, it's unexpected but positive.
Awesome.
But if not for the suffering that I've done in grad school, maybe I won't be able to do this now.
Sure. Well, I guess along those lines, in terms of keeping your own students from suffering too much, has there been anything that you've done yourself to kind of like build your management or mentoring skills and make you a better PI for the people who work under you?
There's no hierarchy in the lab. I think everyone is important, and so everyone is expected to contribute ideas and good research. I have experienced both ends of the spectrum in terms of lab culture. You know, on one end, where it's a very hands-on PI who's a slave driver. On the other hand, is the hands-off PI. And I much prefer the hands-off culture, because I think it promotes a more vibrant and a creative and happy environment. So I kind of reflect that from my time as a graduate student. So I think by simply giving every lab member the independence and the ability to pursue their own projects, the team is very happy and excited about our goals. The responsibility of me as a PI, first of all, is to get the resources to do the science, but also to just discuss the ideas and try to impart my expertise, but not as a manager. Mm-hmm. I think we try to run the lab as almost a startup kind of culture, where it's a team. Everybody works together. You know, my office is always open. So that's one thing I also observed from George. So anyone can just walk in, interrupt me and chat. And, you know, we just keep this open communication between every member of the lab. Mm-hmm. So I think it removes the barriers. And in terms of the science, you know, we expect everyone to do important, meaningful science that impacts society, you know, for publication. So things that people will find useful and important. So I think that is that kind of meaning drives a strong motivation in people. And I can see that people in the team really find huge motivation and meaning when they're in the lab. So even if there's no culture of being in the lab all the time, you know, being forced to be in the lab or having to produce results all the time, people are intrinsically motivated to do so. Mm-hmm. You know, just by their own initiative.
Yeah. So I guess, do you explicitly say these things to people when they're thinking about coming to work at the lab? Yeah.
Yes. So our lab has two key requirements. One is got to be independent and creative, and ambitious. That's one requirement. The second requirement is you've got to be nice. So,
very important.
I think that's maybe requirement one, and then requirement two is independence.
Yeah.
I think it's key to our success, because we cannot operate in a manner where people are following instructions and following routine protocols, and we expect them to produce good technologies. Mm-hmm. Because after all, we are trying to invent new stuff.
Yeah.
So that is definitely a key factor that we're looking for.
Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds great. Do you want to go over any, like, your favorite project that's going on in the lab right now, or a project that you're most excited about? Oh, and one quick logistical question. So how many people are in your lab?
So right now we have three people in the lab, well, four including me. By the end of this year, so the next one, we'll get three more people, so
six
people.
Okay, yeah.
By half a year's time, I think we'll be around 10 to 12 people.
Nice.
I mentioned, you know, the funding is excellent here.
Yeah.
And we have many people excited to join the course. I mentioned to you that we are building the first gene therapy center in the region. It's constituted by four pipelines.
Mm-hmm.
So four main big picture projects. One of the key competencies of the lab is to build cutting-edge genome editing tools that edit the human genome. We try to develop tools that include CRISPR-based or adapt new systems from, you know, bioinformatics or through engineering, rational design, or high-throughput selection. So developing new genome editing tools.
What kind of problem are you trying to tackle there? Like, what do you see that's missing in the array of genome editing tools that are out there now?
Efficiencies of making specific edits is really key. So in the past, people have been thinking a lot about specificity of CRISPR, but I think now we are going into safety, in the clinical sense, and also into efficiency or efficacy in terms of treatment. So there's been very cool technologies in base editing.
Yeah.
As especially David Liu's lab. So those allow you to change one letter in the genome, you know, very precisely. What we are desperately lacking in the community is some technology that allows us to change bigger stretches of the genome in a very precise manner.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of safety and efficacy, you know, this also relates to another pipeline of the lab, which is develop gene therapy vectors, you know, especially AAVs.
Mm-hmm.
We are big fans of AAVs.
So, so are we.
Oh, cool. Yeah, that gene has been distributing AAVs nowadays.
Yep.
So we want to build the pipeline to package and produce very high-grade AAVs,
mm-hmm.
Packaging CRISPR systems or beyond CRISPR systems, just any kind of genetic material. So we'll produce those at scale,
mm-hmm.
Approach clinical grade, and of course, GMP is a long-term vision,
mm-hmm.
and then we have some engineering to evolve AAVs to be more specific for particular human tissues or for more robust transduction efficiencies.
Mm-hmm.
The other pipeline that I was alluding to is also the safety issue, which is the immunogenicity of these therapeutics.
Okay.
You know, gene therapy has always been that's a lot of work, you know, decades of work being done in gene therapy in terms of immune response. Now we are faced with a new generation of therapeutics in CRISPR and delivery modalities. So one key focus of the lab is to determine the human immune response, how the human immune response is evoked by this protein therapeutics or viruses.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll try to set up some in vitro systems to do that. And through high throughput assays and engineering of these therapeutics, we'll try to minimize the immunogenicity of CRISPR and AAVs.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Yeah.
So I know AAVs have very low immunogenicity in general compared to a lot of other vectors. If you delivered, I guess, of the ways you can deliver CRISPR, is AAV kind of the least immunogenic that there is right now?
Well, compared to the other viruses, it's definitely one of the best.
Mm-hmm.
The other potentially exciting modalities, one is the ribonucleoproteins, the RNPs, mm-hmm. so purified forms of CRISPR-Cas9 with the guide RNAs.
Mm-hmm.
So those degrade very quickly, and those can be delivered in a very localized manner. So I think it gives kind of a more pinpoint approach to therapeutic delivery, and hence potentially less of an immune exposure.
And they last long enough to in like a whole animal to actually cause the edit?
It has been done in a localized manner,
mm-hmm.
In mice. The other modality that I think of, which I guess there are many modalities, but in terms of a modality that excites me would be modified RNA.
Cool. So you guys are kind of testing all these different possibilities within your in vitro systems to see how much immunogenicity each has and what would be kind of the best way to go forward.
Yes. Well, we still focus quite heavily on AAVs simply mm-hmm. because, you know, starting from a better vector, mm-hmm. in our opinion. But at the same time, we will look at other modalities, which I think has advantages over viruses in that it is, as I mentioned, very pinpoint and localized.
Mm-hmm.
It degrades very fast.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Awesome. All right. So those were three of your pipelines. Do we still have one more to go?
The fourth pipeline is anything that is cool, any
okay.
cool biotechnology. So,
yeah.
you know, the culture in the lab is that, you know, even though we have broad pictures as to what kind of science we want to pursue simply because we have expertise in it, we really do not constrain people from pursuing any ideas that they want to.
Mm-hmm.
And so, as long, you know, the key criteria that we have is that is important for society, and it's not just for you to publish a paper or pump out a couple of papers. So in that case, that's the fourth pipeline, and I think you'll find new ways of doing things. You'll find new technologies in reading or writing DNA or just any form of biotech.
Cool. Can you give you guys haven't been around for a long time, but can you give any specific examples of kind of like a cool project that you're working on?
Reading and writing DNA is definitely a key focus of the lab. Mm-hmm. So technologies to write DNA, be it in vitro or in vivo. Mm. We also want to do some novel ways of DNA assembly or synthesis and directed evolution.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I won't push you too much on there, but I'll be excited to see what comes out of all of it. So then I guess my last question for you will be, I guess, do you have any advice for young researchers who are looking to pursue careers in academia like you're doing?
I think in academia, you encounter failure about 95% of the time, especially in your experiments. So if you add on a few other problems and applications, with other people, finances, for example, then makes graduate school one of the most uncertain periods in your academic career. But one key point is everybody survive. So simply don't let go. Just keep going.
Yeah.
I had a friend who told me this advice before I even started graduate school. He said, because research is always for failure, you know, scientists should try to find satisfaction from other sources that are also, you know, just some other activities that give you constant rewards and reinforcement. So that could be gardening or something. I mean, it depends on what you are into. Try to find something else to do, and I would say be super ambitious, because this is actually a very excellent time for you to take huge risks. Yeah, I feel that I have taken very, very huge risks when I was in graduate school, and it paid off, but I feel that I could take even greater risks. Because you are training to be a scientist, and you want to build multiple good stories coming out from this training. And finally, just be nice to people.
Yeah. I think that's a great piece of advice to end on, because I think that ties into everything, really. You'll get more collaborators if you're nice. You'll be able to figure out more ideas by interacting with people if you're nice, all sorts of stuff. It was great talking with Wei Lung, and it sounds like we'll be learning about some interesting new technologies coming out of his lab in the years to come. For more updates and insights from researchers in the biological sciences, be sure to subscribe to the AdGene podcast. Let us know how we're doing by leaving us a review on iTunes or commenting on this episode's associated blog post on the AdGene blog. AdGene, a better way to share science.